This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel, the global leaders in sustainable small group travel experiences. If you're ready to feed your curiosity with real-life experiences, Intrepid has got the perfect adventure just for you. Visit intrepidtravel.com to book your next trip today. You have to be careful with bucket lists. You have to make sure you don't become too obsessed with them, that you don't spend your traveling life trying to tick boxes rather than just have enjoyable experiences. Some of the real joys of travel are spontaneous. They're unexpected, unplanned. That said, though, there really are certain experiences that you should strive for, that you should definitely do. These are the absolute highlights of the travel world, the places and activities that even seasoned travelers would put above all else. I'm talking unique, unforgettable, top-shelf experiences, like trekking to see mountain gorillas in Rwanda or spending a night exploring in Tokyo. Things like working on a super yacht or doing a bar crawl in San Sebastian. That's what today's episode is all about, the absolute best of the best. The six experiences that our panel believes you have to have at least once in your life. The ones everyone should make it their goal to enjoy. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. This episode is a little different from the rest. On this episode, we're not going to go with a theme or a particular destination. We're not sharing anecdotes of trials and disasters. Instead, the three of us on the panel are each choosing two travel experiences that we've absolutely loved, the best of the best, and telling you how to make them happen. So let's introduce that panel. First up, he's a writer for traveller.com.au who's becoming something of a regular on Flight of Fancy and has worn the same pair of shorts on every episode, Rob McFarlane.
Hello, Rob.
Hello, mate.
Good to have you on board. Also joining us, she's a writer, editor, and influencer who once spilled a drink on Cindy Crawford, Georgia Rickard. Hi, Georgia.
Hello, Ben.
Good to have you. We are going to hear about this Cindy Crawford incident, aren't we?
we'll see.
Later on in the episode, I think so. I think it's interesting, like I asked you guys beforehand to name your two experiences, and none of us have really gone with traditional sites, like things like the Eiffel Tower or the Statue of Liberty, or, you know, we've gone for kind of more organic experiences, I think, or sort of long-term experiences. Do you guys find that, you know, interesting that this is not typically what travellers talk about?
Absolutely. You know, because I think that what is really most memorable, looking back, you know, for me when you first asked me to have a think about what my top two would be, is that really the best travel experiences are the best, oh, this is so corny, the best travel experiences are the best life experiences,
yeah.
You know, and it's so much about the stories that you come away with where you've grown as an individual.
Yeah, and in some ways it's not even about the location. It's more about the things that you do or the way it changes you.
Indeed, and I think, you know, it might not necessarily be about, it could be more about the people.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure. Rob, do you think, are things better when you just sort of let them happen? Do you
think these experiences? I think so. I mean, I think it's that fine line between enough planning so that you know what's going on, you know where to go, and you're not sort of lost and floundering around, but leaving enough time for spontaneity and to be able to do the things that you want. And I think there's this real, and I still find this when I go somewhere, there's this sort of tick box mentality where you think, well, I've got to go and see the Statue of Liberty. I've got to go and see the Eiffel Tower. I've got to go and see Christ the Redeemer because it's the thing that everyone does when they go to those cities. And often they're super crowded. They rarely do they live up to the hype, I find. And yet it's when it's the afternoon after you've done that where you stumble across a little bar or you go and do something little off the beaten track. And that's what you remember and that's what you rave to people about. Very rarely do you hear people raving about those iconic attractions. It's the other things that they've done on their trip which tend to stand out.
Yeah, and I think all six of the experiences that we're going to talk about today, they're kind of loose in a way. Like they're ideas. They're not really tied to absolutely specific locations a lot of the time. They're just sort of ways that you can experience the world.
Indeed.
So let's get right into it because we don't have that much time, sadly. So Rob, your first one is doing a safari.
Exactly.
I mean, it's sort of a classic experience in a way, but what is it about that you really love?
I think it is the most immersive types of trips that I've ever done. There's something incredibly visceral about safaris.
Yeah. And this is in Africa we're talking. In Africa?
Africa gets all the glory for safaris. And certainly places like South Africa has got some incredible lodges.
Yeah.
But you can go and do safaris in Kenya, in Tanzania.
Yeah.
I've done ones in India. Mm-hmm. The Galapagos is a safari of types. So there's lots of different places you can do them in the world. And for me, it's as much about, so normally what happens is you get woken up really early.
Yeah.
It's dark. dark, and there's this incredible anticipation about what you're going to see that day. Yeah. You get bundled into a Jeep, you're all sort of wrapped up with a hot cup of coffee, and then you trundle out, say, into the African bush with no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's quite different from most of the holiday experiences that people have, where it's very planned and very, you know, scheduled. And it's, I just love that. Even talking about it now, I get that feeling.
There's a real primal appeal to it as well, which maybe is completely in my head. But, you know, that, as you say, that feeling of rising before dawn and making a fire and you know, having a cup of coffee and then going out and taking on the world in a way. You know, that there's stuff out there that can kill you.
And it gets pretty, I mean, there's been times in safaris when I've been genuinely scared, right? Really scared. And it's interesting because when you talk to the guides afterwards and you watch the guides go through this sort of escalation technique of managing a situation, say, with an elephant or a rhino, what have you, and you realize upset partner, and you realize that they are so far within their comfort zone of all the other things that they've experienced. But for you, you know, who's not used to being in that situation, it is, it's totally terrifying.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've had that whole heart in my mouth experience on numerous occasions on safaris. And that would be, if I could only do one trip again in my lifetime, it would be a safari.
Yeah, right.
Wow, that's a big call.
It's a big bold call.
Is there a particular destination that you think is...
The ones, I mean, the most memorable tend to be the high-end lodges in South Africa. So South Africa's got some extraordinary... So that's where... it made me laugh about lighting a fire. So, my butler does that.
As I was saying that, I could see you look at me like,
watching my butler make the fire is one of my favourite parts of the day. And so there's places like Subi Subi and Singita, and they just do that stuff really, really well. And you get to go out there, you see extraordinary animals. They've got private reserves.
I mean, you have absolute professionals leading you as well.
Totally,
you have a tracker sitting on the front of the vehicle, and he can look down and see a print from an elephant and tell you which elephant it is.
Exactly. Like it's extraordinary. That to me, and often they're indigenous people from the native communities who've grown up in those places. I just did one in Ecuador, and so that's actually an interesting another place. You don't really think of safaris with South America, but I did one in the Amazon part of Ecuador, and we went out with the native guides. And there was one point where this guy spotted these three owls, and we were walking through the forest and he spotted them. And even when he told me where they were, it still took me like a minute to find them in the phone. How did you ever spot that as we were walking through? And the same with the guides when they're sitting on the front of the trucks going through. And also you get to interact with those people and learn about their stories and how they live and how they use the forest for medicinal reasons. So, that's definitely by far my favorite.
I was at a fairly high-end resort in South Africa called Pinda Lodge, and there was a tracker, a Zulu guy on the front, and we were driving along at night and you know, at a fair clip going back towards the lodge, and he suddenly said, you know, stop. And by the side of the road in a bush, there was this, like a chameleon, basically, an insect that was camouflaged against the tree. And you're like, come on.
How did you
see that? Like, I mean, did you just place it there when we weren't looking? Like, everyone look over there and, like, stick the chameleon to the tree?
I mean, it is extraordinary, isn't it? Their ability to do that is just, supernatural.
And I was actually a little bit upset about this choice of yours because you pretty much stole one of mine, so I had to change mine.
Sorry,
man. Because I was going to say one experience is a self-drive safari around Southern Africa, which is something my partner and I did a few years ago, and it was the best trip of my entire life. It's a much different experience to the high-end lodges that we've maybe been talking about before that. But basically, you hire a ute with a tent on the roof, and you take all your supplies, and you go and drive.
Good God.
And you go and you drive around South Africa and Namibia and Botswana and Zimbabwe and Zambia, and you stay in national parks. You camp out at night. You know, you make a fire. You cook your own food. You can hear lions roaring out in the distance as you sort of curl up on top of the ute at night.
But I feel like what is so amazing about that is that, you know, obviously it's an amazing experience, but that would have transformed you.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you would have learnt so much about yourself and come away with a slightly different person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, part of it is sort of the challenge and the adventure of it is, you know, taking on all this foreign country and this place that you're scared of and that you don't really understand and figuring out how to survive. Like just going into a supermarket and thinking, you know, what can you buy here? What rates is food? And there's just a whole lot of very small experiences that add up on a trip like that. Building a fire each night, you know, and the ritual of it, like you just, when you live outside like that, you just take in so much more of what's happening around you. Every single sunset was an event because you're outside and you see
it
and you make a gin and tonic and you sit down and you make a point of watching the sunset and enjoying that. And that's just not something you get to do in everyday life.
Absolutely not. How delicious.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's a really good point because I think people always associate those places Black Africa with the very high-end safaris. And I actually didn't realize you could do self-drive stuff around there. But I've met, obviously, you've done one. I've met a company recently that did it. And that's quite a common thing to do. Like you have a bit of training with a four-wheel drive, but then you go off and you can drive through those national parks and have a pretty similar experience.
Get to see some of the same things. Out, you know, you won't see the chameleon in the tree as you're driving home. But you know, you can still have it. It's a very different experience, I find. Like you don't see anywhere near as many animals as you do when you're in that high-end places with the amazing guides.
But every animal you see would be very
it feels
hard
like
won,
such an achievement.
Know?
Like you spot a rhino and you're like, damn, like I found that.
And there's
thing.
An intrepidness about it. You know, you're driving through Africa. I mean, how cool is
you're
that?
You're taking it all on, All right, we're going to have to move on. Georgia, you're up next. And the one that you have mentioned is working on a super yacht.
Now, yeah,
take us through this.
Slightly
idea.
Different speed, but...
Slightly different.
The
I don't
idea...
know. That's the idea of luxury to it.
Well, it wasn't... No, it's not... I mean, it is a luxurious experience, but the reason I selected that was... it was quite a transformative experience for me. And, you know, I learned so much about myself. And, look, I didn't actually set out to work... on the super yachts in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean. Yeah. I basically tried to be a backpacker. I went over to Europe and discovered like quite quickly that I'm actually not a backpacker, which is weird because as an Australian, I just assumed that I would be a great backpacker, right?
See, I never would have assumed that about you.
Well, I know that now. Now, of course, but I thought it was just a thing that everybody loved. And after, you know, a couple of nights in hostels, I was like, no, this is not for me. But what was so great about working on the super yachts, and I'm going to draw a really long bow here and actually compare it to visiting developing nations, in that when you work on the super yachts, you get to see how other people live.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
It's
but
such,
the opposite end of
but
the scale.
The opposite. And, you know, you do. You learn so much. I mean, the extreme and extraordinary level of wealth that I became quite accustomed to very quickly. You know, there was one boat I worked on, and that's what you call them, by the way, just casually, boats.
Boats, yeah.
And I remember all of the rooms were the walls and the ceilings were made of suede. And I know this because I had to vacuum them every day, which is
the walls.
Nuts. Who vacuum? You know, I had to learn how to fold toilet paper in the most outrageous and intricate ways. The level
what sort of people
luxury.
Own these boats?
It's all sorts, you know, Russian billionaires. I worked on one boat for an extended period of time and actually crossed the Atlantic in it, which is an incredible experience, which I might talk about in a bit more detail if we get the opportunity. But I worked on this one boat that was owned by a gentleman who owned many, many shopping malls in America. He was American and he it was weird, actually. He would come on this boat with his family. And then his wife would leave and then his mistress would arrive the next night. And, you know, you'd have to turn down. No, look, definitely not my type. But it was, you know, it was just, you know, there were only five rooms in on that boat. But it had three levels. We had a helicopter on the back. And, you know, you would just, the way that you would have to look after these people was just absurd. Every time anyone took a shower, for example, you would have to then sneak into the cabin after they had left and wipe it down to the point where it was bone dry, the entire bathroom.
Right.
So that every time they had a shower, it was like the first time anyone had ever taken it. It was a virgin shower. I mean, it was just nuts.
Yeah. So was the appeal of this experience, do you think, more on a human level? Or, I mean, you must have got to visit some pretty amazing places as
I
well
absolutely
from, a,
did.
From a travel sort of perspective.
I absolutely did. So this was, I'd actually arrived and I decided that I was going to set myself up in France for an extended period of time. And I just sort of thought, oh, I'll do it for a bit of cash. And it was the same year that Pamela Anderson was marrying Kid Rock in Saint-Tropez, and Paris Hilton was there, and Kim Kardashian was there, and so they were all, you know, at this celebrity wedding. And the Cindy Crawford story, I actually was one of the first boats I worked on, and it was a lucky break. It wasn't actually me that spoiled Cindy's lap, shall we say. It was the girl before me who actually was fired for doing so. So I was her replacement,
right,
and I got on this yacht. And, you know, I mean, it just became common, the sorts of guests that you would have. I mean, obviously there'd be a little bit of excitement when you were on Eric Clapton's boat, for example, but that was just, you know, that was your owner. That was who you worked for.
Right.
And it was,
and what
it was,
sort of jobs do you do?
Well, so there's two main jobs. You can be a stewardess or hostess, which is basically like you're doing everything in the interiors of the boat, or you can be a deckie, which basically is just means you are cleaning a boat. It's like a big car wash constantly. You're
right.
Cleaning top to bottom, which is terrible. But
not like painting the Golden Gate Bridge, isn't it, where by the time you finish one end, it's time to go back to and start again at the other.
Absolutely, that's it. And that's all you do. But it was a real life lesson in that one of the clearest things that I remember was that the people that owned the boats that had this fabulous wealth were just as unhappy as the rest of us, really. You know, there was lady who was quite overweight, and she was obsessed with this detox tea. And unfortunately, it was my my job to clean her bathroom, and I now know that the tea is regularly referred to by those who take it as poo roulette, because you never know when you drink it whether you're going to be passing wind or something more, because the whole purpose of this tea is to drink it and make you slim, and that was all she wanted. This overweight woman was just she had all the money in the world, but she was so overweight.
Yeah.
You know, it was actually
really
cleaning toilets.
The tone down of what was quite a highbrow podcast, and so now here we are.
Oh, look, you're welcome.
Georgia Rickard, everybody. Thank you.
Well, that was the final straw, actually. It was cleaning bathrooms, and I just went, I don't want to do this anymore.
Let's sort of sum up why you recommend it to people so highly.
Because from a personal level, I went and I did this, and I got to experience this amazing level of wealth where just money is no object.
Yeah.
And being around that mindset and seeing what's possible and seeing how other people live was actually incredibly inspiring for me in a lot of ways, because I vowed when I stepped off that, you know, the last boat that I worked on, that I would never return to a super yacht unless I was a guest or an owner.
Right. And have you been back on a super yacht since then?
I haven't been back on a super yacht in the Med, but I have had the pleasure of cruising around the Kimberley on the True North, and that was a nice, like, yes, a bit of a coming of age. But, you know, just the experience of seeing how other people live in such an extreme way was really just an extraordinary life lesson.
Yeah.
And I would have thought, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would have thought seeing that sort of level of wealth and realizing that isn't always something to aspire to. Because if you think our society, almost everyone wants to be rich and famous and all the rest of it. And seeing people in that situation who still aren't happy and almost might cure you of that insatiable greed for
that's a really good point.
Amount of money. And so I think that's, in a way, travel's all about that, isn't it? Seeing people in different situations and realizing, oh, hang on, that isn't all it's cracked up to be, or I don't really want to be that person or in that situation.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if that's how you felt, but that's how I imagine I would have felt a little bit about it.
I definitely felt like that, yes, a lot. But the irony is that actually on those boats, I also had the most incredibly soulful experience, the singular most soulful experience of my life. And it was when we crossed the Atlantic, which was a wild and woolly journey that accidentally involved a detour via Africa. But at one point when we actually made it out into the open sea, it was an extraordinarily calm day. And in every single direction, the water was so flat and so calm, and you could see the horizon. There was nothing else around. There was, you know, virtually no sound. It felt like I was inside a computer-generated program. Like it was just the wildest, most quiet, peaceful moment. I felt infinite and tiny at the same time.
Yep.
It was really, really something.
That's cool. All right, well, we're going to have to move on. It's time to move on to one of my choices.
Uh-oh.
My first choice is a night out in Tokyo. It's a fairly simple concept, fairly simple idea, but to me, Tokyo is just, it is the city. I love cities in general, but Tokyo is the biggest and the baddest and the craziest and the weirdest of them all.
It really is.
And it's such a, like, I wouldn't call it a 24-hour city. Like, there are a lot of parts of Tokyo that shut down pretty early. Like, you know, people tend to eat dinner at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock and they're done. And so a lot of the suburbs closed down, but this is a city that around places like Shibuya and Shinjuku and Ginza and Ebisu, it just, there's always something to do for an entire night. And I mean, there's a Murakami novel about just set in one night in Tokyo and these sort of bizarre and sometimes magical things that happen. And to me, that makes so much sense as someone who's spent a lot of time in the city, because to me, it does feel magical. It feels like it's like a choose your own adventure type thing. Like you go out and you think you know what your night is going to be, and then you meet people and you go down this path and you go into this little bar and you meet some more people and you end up at an arcade parlor, and then you're doing karaoke, and then you're at a batting cage, you know, hitting baseballs, and and then you're in some weird themed club, and I mean, there's just so
Keep it PG.
There's just so much to do there, so many options, and so, you know, so many adventures to go on in a night in Tokyo, and that's not even touching on the fact that the food in that city is just, to me, it's the greatest eating city in the world. There's just every izakaya you go into, which are like these sort of casual bar type things. They're almost like a tapas bar, basically. We have small plates of food, do incredible food. You know, there's all these ramen restaurants that are open 24 hours a day that do amazing food. There's really high end restaurants. There's, you know, little places in between that do great food. It's just, you know, you could spend your entire night from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. just eating, and that would be a really great way to spend an evening there.
Well, I think one of the magical things about Tokyo is that it feels properly foreign.
Exactly.
It does. Yeah. It does.
You know, there really aren't that many cities left that are like that. But when you, as you say, when you step out, it's. I remember having a moment in Tokyo, and I think it was in Shibuya, and I stood at that crossing, and I was just so utterly overwhelmed. My boundaries were being violated in every possible. It was just insane. It's almost overwhelming. Yeah. But it's as you say, magical. Yeah.
And the thing I really enjoy is that there is a really weird side to Tokyo. There's a lot of bizarre stuff. You know, there's themed cafes and bars and you know, sort of fetish style S&M places and you know, you can experience all that if you want to. But there's also just really sort of normal traditional stuff that goes on there that maybe isn't as crazy to tell your friends about, but it's just, you know, the smoky little whiskey bar with the guy there who's obsessed with jazz and who has this huge record collection. You know, just fairly standard stuff that is not gonna make the news or anything, but that's just the way people live. And you can, again, you can get in there and enjoy that and experience it and as a traveler.
Yeah, I think it's almost that breadth of experience, isn't it, that you can get there. I remember I've only been to Tokyo once, but I ended up in a maid cafe playing Mario Kart against a girl who was a 217-year-old ghost with this whole backstory about it. And of course, she, you know, pummeled me at Mario Kart because that's all she does is just play Mario Kart all day.
She's been playing it for 217 years.
Well, exactly. She's good pretty good at it now. And I just thought, I can't imagine doing this anywhere else. And I think the other thing which sets Tokyo apart and almost Japan in general is that it's safe. So you can have all these adventures
and not feel too
dodgy about it. Yep. I think it's almost the most foreign place I've been where I haven't felt out of my comfort zone in terms of safety because you can go and do all these crazy things and most of the time it's going to be okay.
Yeah, most foreign cities, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You have to be very aware of your safety and knowing places before you go there. Whereas Tokyo, you can just sort of open yourself up to chance and move around like that.
Yeah.
And we haven't even mentioned the live music scene there as well, which is huge. Japanese people are really into music, really into live music. Okay.
I did not know that.
The whole city is filled with what they call live houses, which are small concert venues. And quite often they're not really well marked. You know, you really have to know that they're there. They're often a lot of post-war buildings were built with bomb shelters in the bottom of them, apartment blocks and stuff, and so a lot of those have been converted into live music venues. And so
is this like rock music? I'm assuming it's rock
it's
music.
Every genre of music you can think of. The jazz is fabulous. There's a really big jazz scene there, really big blues scene. There's also I love punk rock. There's a huge punk rock scene there. There's alternative indie. There's J-pop, like really cheesy sort of stuff. It's just huge. Japanese people love live music.
And actually,
there's a real passion for it.
I was just in Nashville, and there was a Japanese bluegrass band that had been flown over from Japan to play at this festival that I was at, and that totally took me by surprise. I wouldn't even thought that was a drummer they even knew about, let alone were good at it. And the guy who was there went in for a banjo picking contest and came second out of the whole south of America. You think how many good banjo pickers are there?
I mean, it's that thing that when Japanese set their mind to doing something, they get good at it.
Totally,
they get really good.
And he was totally emotional when he played, totally emotionless, but was incredible.
I've seen some of the weirdest experimental bands of my life in Tokyo because you go along to these venues and you don't really, like, mostly it's written in Japanese and I can't read Japanese, so you don't really know what the band's going to be like. You kind of know what the venue's known for, what style of music it's known for. So you have but there's usually a lineup of four or five bands on, and I've seen some really strange bands, you know. And some
how
really
perfectly
great
Japan.
Whether it's a curiosity to explore a new destination or try a dish you've never heard of before, a small group adventure with Intrepid Travel is your all-access pass to uncover those once-in-a-lifetime experiences. Whatever adventure inspires you, Intrepid Travel has got you covered. Whether you'd rather spot wildlife on an Africa safari or search for the best pizza in Italy, maybe sail around the Galapagos Islands, hike across the glaciers in Patagonia, or visit Antarctica on a cruise, there's something for everyone. Start planning your unmissable adventure at intrepidtravel.com.
Rob, you're up. It's back to you.
Right.
Now, your next choice is any sort of wilderness trip.
Mm-hmm.
Please explain.
Right. So the premise behind this is that it can be any trip where you are taken out of your normal world. You're away from Wi-Fi coverage. You're away from your phone. You're away from all those distractions that we have in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I particularly enjoy rafting trips. So I've done a whole bunch of multi-day rafting trips in the States and in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're extraordinary. And they do lots of things on lots of different levels. A, they get you into places where you probably can't get to any other way. So these canyons, you know, parts of the Grand Canyon you can't get to apart from on a raft.
These are often quite active journeys, like you're hiking or you're rafting.
They can be, and that's certainly an element of it.
As differ from the safari, where it can be kind of a sort of...
passive.
Yeah, sort
definitely.
Of experience.
But what's interesting about this is a lot of people don't do these trips because they think they're going to be really active and they think they have to be incredibly fit.
Yep.
You can go down a raft through the Grand Canyon and just sit there and someone else does all the work. You don't have to be particularly, you know, fit in order to do that. So you
to
can
be
have
honest,
that
Rob, like knowing you, that actually, I feel, sounds a lot more like something that you would do, especially if you had a martini in hand.
Well, this is where I will surprise you, George, because beneath this this debonair exterior is a rugged outdoorsman. And so whenever I've done these trips, I've paddled, and actually in the Grand Canyon, they put myself and my brother in this little two-man ducky, and we did the rapids on our own. And, I mean, that trip's still probably one of my favourite trips that I've ever done. So you get to go to extraordinary places.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you,
is the human element part of this for you, that sort of shared adventure that you're off and on?
It can be.
Like
I mean, that was great because I did it with my brother, but I've done lots of them where you're just with a group. But there's still
a human element to that. You're still bonding with people that you're...
Totally. But what I was going to say is for families, it's particularly good because you get...
Right.
On the rafting trips, you get kids who spend their entire time glued to phones and iPads and TVs. They don't have those for the duration of the trip, and they start playing with each other and they start bonding with other kids and they start jumping off of, you know, cliff jumps and they do stuff outside.
Yep.
And the change that you see in them over a course, particularly if it's like a 4 or 5 day trip, is really quite revelatory.
It's really,
and the guides always say that. They say when you watch families, the way that they bond over those trips, it's really quite incredible.
Yeah,
and it could be rafting, it could be hiking, it could be horseback riding, anything which takes you out of... And suddenly all the tiny things become amazing, like a hot cup of tea at the end of the day or a warm bed or washing your hair for the first time in 4 days, you know, all that stuff. It just brings you back down to a base level where you start to appreciate things at a level you don't normally in, you know, in everyday life.
Yeah, right. Any particular locations that you would recommend?
For rafting, I think America does it really, really well. So the Grand Canyon is a great place to do it in.
Yep.
You can do it on the Rogue River in Oregon. You can do it in the Middle Fork in Idaho. Probably the best trip I think I've ever done in rafting was the Futaleufú, which is in South America, which goes down through the just extraordinary scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And you are miles away from anywhere.
Yeah.
Hiking, I mean, New Zealand's got amazing hiking, all those tracks, those multi-day tracks over there. Australia.
Andes as well, Peru has some amazing hiking.
Tasmania's got great hikes.
Yeah.
Multi-day cycling trips, probably not to the same level of wilderness, but you can sort of recreate that to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But anything where you're removed from phones and Wi-Fi and all that stuff that we tend to get really busy with in day-to-day. And you start listening to things and seeing things.
Yeah. And to sort of take it back to what I was talking about earlier with the safaris, that self-drive safari when you're camping, that also takes you away from all that modernity.
Totally.
You know, there's no phone signals out there. You can't use an iPad or anything. And
that
was one of the aspects that I really enjoyed about it, actually.
And you come back a changed person. It really, I mean, often you lose it within a day of getting back to Sydney or wherever it is.
I'm not interested in all this rampant consumerism of, there's a new iPhone.
Exactly.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. But it's good to have those little breaks from ordinary life.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even think it's just good. I think it's necessary. You know, a wilderness trip, I mean, what the term of man's affinity with nature has a name, biophilia. Like, we are so connected to the external environment. And when you actually, I think, step, without wanting to go all woo-woo.
Too late. Biophilia, that's where that went.
But when you spend time, you know, in a place away from phone reception and power lines, you really just can sort of get back in tune with not just your surroundings but yourself, and it's just a relief. It's such a lovely thing to do.
For sure.
Necessary.
Yeah. Now on that note though, Georgia, your second choice is completely the opposite of that. Because you've said visiting New York City.
Oh no.
Nothing gets you away from humanity and really lets you check out like New York City.
Look, yes. And I chose that again because it was such a formative experience for me. And for a couple of reasons. I do think that every Australian should spend time in America.
Yeah.
Because, you know, British might be our motherland, but I think our cultural parent is the US. And you understand so much more about Australia and the way that we've idolised America, I think, from actually going there. And it also does give you a deep sense of appreciation for everything in Australia that we have that America doesn't.
Yeah.
But in New York particularly, as a 20-year-old, flinging myself over there, my first international trip, I was alone. I arrived and I had my boyfriend at the time, who was 30, who was coming over to join me to set up the New York offices of his new company, which was a big deal for him, and you know, he was under a lot of pressure. But I was very alone. It became very clear very quickly that he was under a lot of pressure, and mm-hmm. and that I was going to have to learn to cope on my own in this crazy city where I knew no one and had never had to define myself as mm-hmm. anything other than, you know, a girl who went to X school and grew up in Y area.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinarily confronting. Mm. And New York can be. And I think that's such the unromantic part of travel that no one really warns you about, is learning to define yourself and interact with people in ways that are so outside your normal context that you
and
really
it's
have
amazing
to,
that you can be in a place of millions of people and feel totally alone.
And yet it's such a common experience in New York, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just in travel generally, I think
you find New Yorkers fairly friendly?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Incredibly.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was tough. My partner left to go overseas traveling for a few weeks and I spent 3 days crying in bed, but then I got out and I really started to take myself traveling.
Yeah.
And learned that, you know, no, this is who I am and this is what I'm about. And it's, you know, whether it's in New York City or another major metropolis, I think learning to put yourself completely outside your comfort zone in another culture, and define yourself in on your own is kind of vital to human development, really, in the modern day and age.
I know with New York, I always had this, before I visited there, I had this frustration that New Yorkers always seemed to sort of, it always felt to me like they thought that New York was the center of the universe. And then you arrive there and you spend a bit of time and you're like, it's kind of it is, isn't it?
Yes, it's true. I remember being wowed by the fact that they had just introduced cleaners that would come to your house and they offered like green, sustainable cleaning, which was like the hugest thing back then because it was just so different. But I was like, wow, New York really is the center of the universe. That proves it.
What's a day in New York for you? What would you do?
Oh, look, one of the most memorable days I ever had was just getting up and taking myself shopping on this gorgeous date, you know, spending some time in Central Park, doing all the cliched things. But the pinnacle of that day, which I will remember fondly for the rest of my life and which I totally think everybody should do, was I went and I had a 3-course dinner by myself at Balthazar.
Right.
And, you know, Balthazar's, a beloved restaurant downtown. It's a bistro that has, you know, a gorgeous history and whatnot. But spending that much time doing gorgeous things on your own by yourself and looking around at
and it is a city that you can do things like that by yourself.
Absolutely.
There's no stigma against going out for dinner by yourself.
No. It was divine.
Yeah.
And I think what's so interesting about New York is that a lot of people would think, hang on, it isn't that different. You know, they speak the same language and it shouldn't be that culturally challenging. But it is.
I mean,
it really still is. Yeah. And it's so funny how you can have cultures which seem on paper so close together, but when you get there, and I've spent a lot of time in New York, and people don't understand you, and there's this curiosity because you talk differently, and I've become Rob instead of Rob, and there's all these funny little quirks. Yeah, yeah. And so it can be really challenging.
And it's the ultimate melting pot, isn't it? Much as I hate that cliche, but, totally. You know, you walk around Queens and every block, it feels like you're in a different country.
Absolutely.
Sometimes.
Indeed. Yeah. It's still my favorite city in the world. And and every time you go back, there's new experiences to have, there's new things happening. And that whole thing about New Yorkers being unfriendly, you know, really is a myth. They're just busy.
Yeah.
So they're not going to stop and chat for 15 minutes, but they'll always, if you've got a map out and you're looking for directions, they'll always come over and think, but they'll just do it quickly and they'll move on with their day because they've got a million things to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so unlike in Alabama where they'll stop and chat for 4 hours. So it's just they've got stuff to do. And it's a city where you feel like that, don't you? You just feel like, I've got to get up and do stuff
every
day.
That's it.
And get out there and achieve something.
Exactly.
Yes, anything really is possible in that town.
Yeah, it is.
And you see the best and the worst of humanity, I would say, which is another really, you know, compelling reason to go.
Yep. Now, we've only got a little bit of time left, so I'm going to move on to my final one as well. My last one kind of relates to my first one, actually. It's having a Pinchos crawl in San Sebastian. And so San Sebastian is a town in the north of Spain, in the Basque Country. It's quite a small town, but it used to have the most amount of Michelin stars per capita of any place in the world until Kyoto came along and stole that mantle. But it's a place that's obsessed with food. And yeah, there are lots of Michelin star restaurants there, but there are also these bars in the old town in particular. It's filled with bar after bar after bar, very small places that sell pinchos. And a pincho is a spike, which is basically a toothpick. And that's the thing that goes through the food to hold it together. And so a pincho is a very small bite of food, basically a couple of bites of food, sometimes held together with a toothpick, other times not. But you know, you think that would mean it's simple food. Like a lot of tapas in Spain is maybe just chorizo, or it's just garlic prawns or something like that. But the pinchos in San Sebastian are these amazing creations. They're really complex, really interesting. Some very traditional Basque food, some very sort of haute cuisine, modern dining. But everything is small, everything is affordable. Every bar specializes in one specific pincho, and they very happily tell you which one it is when you walk into their bar. And so a pinchos crawl, basically you just walk around the old town, cobbled streets, no cars, very small, very friendly, wander into a bar, ask them what their specialty is, eat that small thing, which will invariably be absolutely delicious, drink a small glass of chacolí, which is the local sparkling wine, and then move on to the next one and repeat and continue on and on and on for as long as you feel like it.
How delicious.
Wow.
There's nowhere else like it in the world that I've experienced.
And is that your meal for the night? Just basically hopping between these places? And
you just graze. You graze. Constantly grazing.
Yeah. And it's very much a part of the local culture. Although there are a lot of tourists in the city, it doesn't feel touristy. It feels very much like an experience that locals do have and are having at that time. It's still they've still sort of held on to the local feel of the place.
And is it one that tourists can access? Because you know how sometimes we go to those places and this is very much a local sport.
Yeah, like there's places in Tokyo, which we've been talking about, where you as a foreigner won't get into that bar because they don't want people who don't speak Japanese in that place, which, you know, I can kind of understand, but it's also kind of frustrating. San Sebastian, you'll never get that. You know, if you want to go in there and speak Spanish, maybe they're not going to like you that much because they're Basque and they want to speak Basque.
Right.
If you learn a couple of words of Basque, like kaixo for hello and eskerrikasko for thank you, people will absolutely love you. And with no pretense or, you know, nothing fake going on whatsoever. It's just genuine and people love food. And if you compliment their food and talk about their food and show interest in it, then yeah.
How gorgeous. Yeah.
They're going to love you. And then you've got all those beaches and everything to help you feel better the next day. I always seem to get really drunk in San Sebastian.
It sounds like eating, drinking half a glass and eating a tiny piece of food at every bar.
They're quite small glasses of wine as well. Right. It's low alcoholic, but there's just such a feeling of celebration and joy in that city. Yeah. For me, anyway, every time I'm there, I just don't want it to stop. Every night, I don't want it to end.
Mm. Especially in summer, right? Yeah, like long, late nights with lots of light and the sun setting at 10 o'clock and everybody out buzzing. And
yeah, that's what it's all about. Yeah, good lifestyle, good culture.
You've sold me.
Well, you should move there.
All right, guys, we do have to finish up. Sadly, we've gone way over as usual. But I'm going to quickly ask you for your third place, the experience that didn't make your list that you wish you could have talked about today as well.
I probably would have gone for New York City, but given that George's already done that, I'm going to go for another US experience, which is a road trip.
A road trip,
specifically in the US. I mean, road trips anywhere are great, but the US is incredibly well set up for road trips, and there is a freedom about driving around the US, which I think is magical.
Yep. Okay.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
I'm going to go two because I just like to break the rules. But I'll keep them quick. The first would be spending some time in the Kimberley in Australia. I can't even talk about it because it's so emotional, really. But it is just breathtaking. It's spectacular. It completely changed my view of Australia. It's deepened my sense of connection with the world around us. And I have been back half a dozen times and want to go back half a dozen more.
Right.
And the other thing I would say is going on a awesome group trip with mates is just one of the best things you can do.
That's true. You really are
creating, when everybody can actually get the schedules to align and you do it, you're creating memories that you'll just remember together forever. You have to do it. You have to prioritize it or it won't get done. And it is one of those things that you can always look back on and smile about. So
Absolutely. And I'm going to say visit the Middle East, anywhere in the Middle East. It's just such an amazing part of the world. You know, cities like Jerusalem and Esfahan, you know, it doesn't really matter which country you go to. I just find it really changes your idea of what the world is, because you hear so many bad stories about the Middle East, and then you go there and you see it's such a hospitable, generous place, and so, you know, historic and beautiful. I think as a traveler, everyone should go there to realize that the world isn't what you read about in the paper.
Absolutely,
it's totally different.
We should point out that Ben is actually sporting a Middle Eastern style shawl at this stage.
I am, yeah.
To get in full character for that.
Indeed, and quite the beard on me as well. Jordan, Rob, thanks so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Really
likewise.
Great having you along. If you'd like to read any travel stories about some of the things we've been talking about, you can find them on traveller.com.au. If you want to keep up with what George is up to, you can find her on Instagram, Georgia Rickard. And of course, please subscribe to Flight of Fancy. You can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. Don't forget to rate and review while you're there. And we'll see you next time on Flight of Fancy. Thanks for listening to this podcast, brought to you by Intrepid Travel. Sign up to the Intrepid e-newsletter for more travel inspiration and to be the first to hear about great deals and competitions. Visit intrepidtravel.com to subscribe today.
Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast, is hosted by Ben Groundwater, produced by me, Annie Dang, recorded by Shannon Browning, and mixed by Lap Fam. Our digital editor is Craig Platt.